I just hope that he can experience unity amongst culture. I just hope that he can experience equality. You know, I can imagine for people that created a foundation for me to even be talking to you today, to be able to achieve the things that I've achieved. You know, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, Maya Angelou, I mean, so many leaders before us that paved the way wanted to see people being able to use the same restroom. You know, that was their goal, and they wanted that. I would love to be able to see communities working together to identify the gap in systemic issues.
Yes.
I would love to see people's, all cultures coming together, because, you know, it shouldn't be an African-American just protesting. There should be all cultures coming together, because if all lives matter, all lives matter, right?
Welcome to the Three Steps to Thrive podcast, where each show will show you three simple, practical, and actionable steps to improve your life or your business. Now, here's your host, James Lamb. And guess what? That's me.
Hi, folks. My name is James Lamb with Three Steps to Thrive. I'm your host. I have a very special edition podcast today, and I have a very special guest. Her name is Dr. Mynisha White. Say hello.
Hello, hello, everyone. So glad to be here.
We're happy to have you, Dr. White. And, you know, one of the things that I'm bringing up today is we're going to talk with Dr. Mynisha White. Dr. Mynisha White is an African-American professional based in the U.S. on the East Coast. And in light of current events with Black Lives Matters, I thought it would be interesting and insightful to speak with a professional. And I'm not sure how to say that otherwise. So just like everything else, at the end, she's going to give us three pointers on how to support the cause. But before that, I'd like to talk a little bit more about Dr. White's experiences, and then we will go from there.
Sure.
So Dr. White is an impact coach and chief strategist. Her story and proven work-life harmony method serves as a valuable resource and guide for high-performing women, teaching them how to create their own work-life harmony so they can live and lead their best life without compromising themselves or their family. Dr. White is a wife, a mother, an Amazon number one bestseller, CEO of the Work-Life Harmony Academy, and, you know, because that's not enough already, she's also the creator of the world's number one holistic self-care and accountability system for women. And so the system is designed to teach women how to live and lead with more meaning and more intent. Essentially, Dr. White understands how to lead somebody to a true state of peace while leading a simpler life, not a more difficult one. Before that, Dr. White served 10 years as founder and executive director of a not-for-profit supporting young girls age 7 to 17. And as the expression goes, I'm using the term doctor because Dr. White does have her doctoral degree from Walden University in the School of Public Policy and Administration with a specialization in nonprofit. She also leads a Tampa Bay e-networking chapter representing 500,000 women, so that's 500,000 women, connected through 118 chapters in North America. And Dr. White was recently interviewed as a featured guest on the Voice America Influencers channel and was trained under America's renowned leaders like Bishop T.D. Jakes and John T. Maxwell Leadership Company. And the best news, Dr. White, is now you can add an extra accolade, and that's you've interviewed on a podcast. Right?
That's right.
I'm pretty sure that's going to be the highlight of your career. All right. But this is a really special one. So normally, and I know we have another interview teed up with you about your company, but this is a really special one. And I was telling Dr. White before, I'm a little bit anxious and a little bit tongue-tied. And normally that doesn't get me. But let's start with some questions. And sure. I'm sure at the moment you're getting a lot of questions directed at you. Is that right?
Well, more so, I'm getting a lot of just compassion and people really wanting to get a better understanding of, you know, what's happening and where do we go from here.
Right. Is that so? So my question to you first is that, is this make you feel good? Does this make, I think this is coming from a place of care and concern, right?
Yes.
Yes. And so does that make you feel a little bit good? I mean, if they didn't care, they weren't concerned, they wouldn't talk to you in the first place. So how does this make you feel? And how are you answering? Like, is it exhausting or can you comment a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when I speak to that, I'm more so speaking to people that have a connection, a relationship with me. They feel that sense of duty to check in and to, I made a post as well, posting my son. I have two boys. And so they responded accordingly with compassion and care. Not to say that that is a universal approach. I think overall, just as I've been sitting back and observing just our society absorbing this, I personally feel that there is a sense of a shock that has taken place for people that have not experienced what we've experienced in the Black African-American community. And a lot of them are still processing it. A lot of them are looking for opportunities to understand, like interviews like this. I commend you for doing this because people are having the ear to hear what people are saying and what is all this rage. And, you know, they're kind of getting bits and pieces and really trying to grasp a sense of understanding. So I think that this is a wonderful time to get as much information about what's happening and seeing if we can get to the root of the issue by having uncomfortable conversations like this. So I do feel like at large, people that are not African American have been a little silent or just uncomfortable or just don't know what to say, you know, so they don't say anything.
You're saying essentially that this has been a long time coming, if I'm reading correctly. So this has affected, you know, it's interesting because I spoke to another person in the same network that you and I are on, and she says that it's every day that it happens. So, but for a lot of us, we don't realize this. Why do you think that is? Is that something that just doesn't come up in everyday conversation, or is it because people don't care? Why is this not more prevalent? Because it seems like it's one of the top things on your mind.
Yeah, I think it has to do with just your personal experiences, you know, right? So the lifestyle and the experiences of the majority of African Americans and, you know, their landscape is different. Their conditions are often different. And so it's no different than a person who may have grown up in a two-parent home and a person who've never experienced the two-parent home. And they grew up with one parent who worked three jobs. If we took race out of it for just a moment and just spoke about it from that standpoint, you would get the same outcome. It's that level of unawareness, that, you know, that level of needing to lean in a little bit more and kind of get outside of our bubble and be a little bit more attentive to the needs of others as we all are trying to live and lead in society together. I think sometimes it's human nature for us to go to what's comfortable for us, what's convenient, what's around us in our culture, and it keeps us ignorant, you know, oftentimes.
Yeah, tell me, because a lot of the listeners are going to be small business owners and entrepreneurs. As a person of color, how has it affected you running a business or growing a business or even developing one? I mean, you have your doctorate. You've been successful at a number of things. Do you, and be honest with me, do you think you've had to work twice or three times as hard as anybody else because of your skin color?
Wow. I absolutely believe that there has been things that I've experienced. And to be honest with you, James, because it's such a systemic issue, that's my stance on it. This is a systemic issue. I'm experiencing it whether a person realizes it or not, you know? It goes down to the policies and things that are in place that an average African-American statistics show, let's use a practical example. We talk about home ownership. You know, statistics show that in order for you to own your own home, there's certain prerequisites that you have to have in place. And student loan debt, when you're looking at a home income to debt ratio, a lot of African Americans, that's like their ticket out. Most of them don't have families that have the means and the resources to put savings aside. Most of them have parents who are working multiple jobs. And so they end up relying on student loans. And so their income to debt ratio ends up impacting them. So when it's time to get a home, this is what I mean by systemic issues. So now I have this roadblock that was been placed there because of the way the system is designed to make, you know, that doesn't work out in the favor of a person that comes from a foundation with the type of conditions that we've had placed in our environment. And so that's what I mean by the systemic. So absolutely, I have, and I will not position myself whatsoever as a victim. Mm-hmm. And I think that many African Americans refuse to do that, but it is a reality, you know, and yes. It's one of those things that I do, because I don't like putting myself in a space as a victim. Mm-hmm. I identify those issues, and I figure out how can I work around this? How can I maximize this? How can I make this so that it's not an excuse? And really, sometimes it will create an advantage for the disadvantage. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, the whole coronavirus thing that hit, a lot of African Americans were accustomed to living in conditions that way. Yes. There were people that, you know, couldn't handle the pressure. They, you know, they even committed suicide, or, you know, they stressed, had anxiety. Mm-hmm. They could not comprehend being in a state of not knowing, when actuality, for many, many, many African Americans in our culture, we've lived in conditions like that. Mm-hmm. So for us, we knew where our hope come from. We knew where to lean towards. We've been in conditions similar. So this is where I say, use your disadvantage as an advantage. And so always looking for that light, you know, always looking for that optimism, that perspective, so that we don't position ourselves as a victim by society, but we're not ignorant to the system at the same time.
Yes, that's a very fine line, isn't it? I imagine there's a lot of temptation sometimes to fall down the rabbit hole and basically say, why bother?
Yes, absolutely. I just saw a post the other day, and it was so heartfelt, James, and she described it like a Monopoly game. Mm-hmm. And she said, just imagine for a minute, if you stepped outside of your bubble and you looked at the history of the African American. I think that's the part that many people, we know about Martin Luther King and things like that, but it stops there. But when you understand the lineage of when we as a people have built Rosewood, for example, mm-hmm. and the story behind Rosewood, we were creating our own economic system, own businesses, we were flourishing. And then it was literally burnt down. You know, that was traumatic to a whole generation, not to mention what took place years before that. So it's almost like this roller coaster of wins and loses, and loses, you know, that is traumatic. And when you don't heal, you have a people that get tired and they begin to rebel. And you see the type of behavior that you're seeing now as a nation.
Tell me about how education plays a role. And I mean this in two ways. Okay. I think the first way I want to know, and I'll recast the question again so you don't forget, but the first question is, for the African American community to get better paying jobs, to get out of that debt cycle, how valuable is education? And I'm going to leave you with the second one is, how valuable is education about the issue you're facing with all other Americans or all other people in the world? Because these protests are happening around the world.
Right? Yes.
And so people are just waking up now, but it's something that you and a lot of your community have experienced every day. So there are two questions in there. One of them is education for the African American community. The second one is education for people really who are not African Americans.
Right. Well, when it comes to education, I know this may seem a bit of an oxymoron because of where I stand in higher education. But, you know, having taken that journey in retrospect, to be honest with you, I did what that community, what we grew up knowing. You got to go to school, get your education, because that's your way out, right? where it's really something that I think that especially the African American community would benefit from if we unlearned, because the educational system has not really served us well, in my opinion, as a majority, not just as a minority. And so I think that there are some things systemically that can be fixed in that education. So when you speak of education for me, I really pride myself on the ways in which I got educated outside of the traditional education and learning and reading and seeking mentorship and investing in myself and things like that. I think that if we have more literacy, I think it's a literacy is a gap. Mm-hmm. And how to survive outside of go to school, get in student loan debt and get here versus, you know, identify a coach and how you, what do you look for in a coach and putting money aside to not spend on frivolous things, but to invest in yourself. Key principles that I think that if our community embraced outside of what we were taught as far as traditional education, I think that that would be the first way in which we could pivot.
Sure.
And because we're very creative and gifted and, you know, embrace entrepreneurship, but we lack a lot of knowledge because a lot of people haven't really been successful before us. So we don't pass down wealth, you know, we don't pass down not just financial wealth, but literacy wellness as well. Yes. That's unable to get passed down. So a lot of African Americans, they have a goal to break generational curses so that they can start that trend of knowledge and wealth building to their children's children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the second part of the question, I guess, is, you know, all of this is coming to a head, but it's really being led by the African American community because everybody else doesn't know. And I don't know how to say it otherwise. It's kind of what you alluded to before. There's a lot of ignorance. It's not choice of ignorance because people choose not to listen. It's ignorance because we just don't know. It's not something that is covered. Do you think education of the systemic issues is kind of a way to equality? Is that one of the things?
Yes. I think that we're spending way too much time thinking about what is going on, what is happening, and not why it's happening. I think if we emphasize the why, then we're able to get to the root that there's something broken in the system. Mm. In the judicial system, in the educational system, in the political system. Let's look at these systems, you know? And that's what I deal with, even with the Work-Life Harmony Method. It's we live in an ecosystem. Everything that we do is derived from a system. And so if we're seeing things that are contrary, that's not adding to our society, it's not adding value to our society, the first thing we should do is look at the system to see, okay, where are the gaps? Where is it broken? Where can we educate ourselves more? Where can we, you know, pull in more literacy, more education, more training, you know, so that we can really deal with the system, you know?
Yep. Tell me with your thoughts on this. When, you know, when we talk about systemic issues, is this and the system really not supporting African Americans at all? Do you think a lot of this is designed or do you think it's cultural? You know, do you think that, you know, you'd like to believe a little bit that people are good at heart, but, you know, we're proven so many times the opposite. Do you think it's a few bad apples or do you think everybody has just a little bit of this racism in them, or probably not everybody, but a lot of people?
Yeah, I think we all, you know, have stereotypes and subconscious biases. I mean, we all can own that in different cultures, and it's based off of what our experiences, what we saw subconsciously and consciously, that causes us to make these conclusions about a culture and causes us to even be insensitive at times. And a lot of times I think it's both, to answer your question. Mm-hmm. I think it's culturally and, you know, I don't know the other word that you use, but I think that there's some intent there. But it goes back to what I was saying initially in our time together, James, is that when the person who's making the policies have not experienced things from the culture, you have somebody at the top making policies that are affecting people that they have no idea what that experience is like, then they can't do it in their favor, right? Because they can't connect. And that's, they can't have compassion. It's a gap there. And then even when you're looking at Congress and you're looking at these people in leadership, it's not really a true representation of what's happening on the lower end of the system, society. And I think that's a gap in itself. It would be great to have everyday people have voices outside of just being able to vote. I think, of course, voting is very, very important. But even creating other ways that people can have a voice as well when it comes to creating systems and not just Congress, creative ways that we can think outside of the box, initiatives that are strategically designed to help systems thrive, to evaluate what's working, what's not working, what do we need to start doing, what do we need to stop doing, what do we need to continue doing. And looking at each system like that with a new lens, we have to roll our sleeves up as a community and do that type of work.
Yes. It's an interesting ask that you have now. Like, I think it's something like I read at one point in time, and I may be wrong here, so I'm just going to say this with a caveat, but I think it's something like 76% of the American population sympathize with your cause, which is amazing. Right?
Yes.
Now, the challenge, I think, in many ways is, unlike the racial protests in the 60s, it's much harder now because by the letter of the law, you should have equality, even though you don't. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Back then, it was segregation. It was very clear. Now it's harder because you're protesting against a system that, in effect, should be fair, even though we've talked about all the inequalities. So it's a much more difficult one, isn't it?
It is because you say that I'm an American and I'm here, taxpayer and doing the obligations as an American, but then I'm not being treated as an American. It's a very disheartening position to stand in.
Do you see this as a grassroots movement, or do you see it something that has to come from the top?
I think it'd be great to see both the top and the bottom take some initiative, but because the top doesn't have the connection, I think that it's going to be up to the grassroots because they have the heart, the experience, the compassion, the passion. They have the insight. So because they have that, I think that it would be, it'll be up to us to get the attention, and to stand on what we believe and to not back down and to, to come together and to create solutions from a grassroots to get their attention.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. I mean, I think a lot of the challenges that you face are not only that by the letter of the law, you are, as you say, American. But at the same time, the longevity of the movement is key too, right? You need to put pressure on the system for as long as you can. It can't be just a flash in the pan, and you already know this.
Yes.
So in Canada, we have something that we do with the First Nations called reconciliation, right? And it's something that, it's a term that's being used at the moment for almost saying sorry for the past sins. How important is reconciliation for African Americans? Is it something where one day you can just wake up and you can just say, you know what, it's true equality and that's good enough? Or does there have to be kind of a process of understanding and healing that goes on?
Wow. I love that you brought this up. I think this is awesome. When I talk to my kids, I introduce trust points to them. And I let them know that in life, you are earning trust points and you're giving people trust points by your experiences with those people. And you just don't carelessly give out trust points with people that are showing you otherwise. You have to use wisdom. And so oftentimes if they do something in the home, I say, you know what? Mommy's disappointed. You've just lost some trust points there. And it's up to you to regain that back. And so helping them to understand that at that level is so important so that they're not vulnerable and naive to passing on trust to people that have shown otherwise and that they're mindful with their actions as well. And so I say that to say that America has to establish trust points with the African American community. And that takes time, you know. It's going to take more than just words. Yes. It's going to take really aggressive action to show this community that there is a change.
Yes.
And I think with the ongoing action, then it will slowly but surely allow trust points and people videotaping positive moments. There was an incident that took place in front of the White House at a Trump rally, and Black Lives Matter was there, and they actually asked the man if he wanted to speak, the leader. And he had 5 minutes on the podium, and it was amazing to see how many people said they never even heard an African American speak with that sense of intellectualism and in a way that they can comprehend the heart of the issue. Because usually when they hear so much anger and so much malice, yes, they were able to really hear for the first time. And at the end of the rally, they were taking pictures with one another. Amazing. And that was a moment of trust points being established. Like, okay, here's a little win, you know? Yeah, we got a lot of work to do, but we're moving forward. And I think if we would show more of that happening, yeah, you know, just like we capture some of the negative things and begin to show that and intentional about showing that on public media and not the negative things that we want to portray on public and media, then that would help to create these trust points. And over time, I think we'll like anything else, you know, time is the best healer if we're doing the right things, you know, yes, during that time.
But the best time to start, I guess, is right now.
Absolutely.
Right? Do you think you're a role model?
I think we all are, you know. It's something that we cannot, you know, move away from. I think that to answer your question, I believe so. And I think we all have that charge. Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting, right? Because it sounds like there's a lot of tension and anger on both sides. But you're right. It's about conversation. And the challenge with anger is when you speak to somebody out of anger, you know, you don't actually listen. So do you think it's important for people, I don't want to call them who are more, you know, who support the cause 100%, but are more moderate in the way that they demonstrate that. Do you think it's important for them to step up and maybe challenge preconceived notions on both sides of the fence, saying you can't say those things, or you need to listen more, or this is not right? What are your thoughts there?
Let me make sure I understand your question correctly. You're saying for those people who are expressing themselves with anger and, you know, profanity and upset, for us to encourage them to express themselves differently?
Well, I guess I'm not explaining it very well. Let me put this way. I have an analogy. Okay. And I know one of my good friends, one of my good friends, her brother grew up in small town British Columbia, which is a province in Canada. And he always, and listeners know I'm Asian, right? I have an Asian descent. I'm from two immigrant parents from Hong Kong. But, you know, this good friend's brother, who I've never met, always says Asian people can't drive, right? Or they're invading our space. And so, you know, my question is it time for my friend to step up and kind of flag that? Or is it?
Absolutely. I get what you're saying now. Yeah. Absolutely. I called it out with someone today. I called it out with a friend of mine. They made a comment and it was so light. And I think it happens within communities because it feels like it's safe. But it's just a bullying a little bit. It's kind of like one of those things where we all are responsible to say, hey, that was racial discriminatory there. That wasn't cool, you know? And I think that that's important. And to even hear, you know, when I listened to that video with the leader talking about Black Lives Matter, I heard a Caucasian woman yell out, yeah, now it's an issue. You guys kill yourself all the time. And now you want to sit here and talk about killing this criminal? Talking about the George Floyd situation, of course. And I was appalled, but that was my first time hearing the other perspective. Yes. So I took it in and said, at least I can understand what made her say that. In her mind, she was thinking he was a criminal. So what if that happened to him? He put himself in that situation and she wasn't able to tap into that compassion side. But again, dealing with the what and not the why, you know, why that happened. And the other part of it is, I think it's important to mention this with, you know, all you guys are killing yourself. You talk about black on black crime, right? And why is this an issue when someone else does it? And you guys are doing that all the time. And I think that when that really sat with me, and when I found the peace in understanding our culture, I think that even black on black, not black on black, killing black on black crime is a myth in itself as well, because that happens in multiple countries and communities, right? But when it's looked at from our culture, it's turned into this big thing, like this is big issue numbers. But again, it goes to a culture of people who work for a society and are depressed. They're getting paid way low. A lot of them came home from prison for making a whole lot of money selling drugs and things like that. Got arrested. Now they have to come back and make $15 an hour for a person who doesn't respect them. And they are trying to do the right thing. And then they have all these different pressures. And the wife is saying they need this. And the kids don't have this. And they can't provide. You have all these different issues that's creating a condition, right?
Yes.
And then you rage and you get angry. The first thing that you're going to do is retaliate on the people around you. You're not going to go to corporate and shoot, you know, go off on your boss or get angry or whatever, because that's that's how you get paid. So the first thing you're going to do, we do it in our home, right? We have a bad day at work. What do? We come home and you get short with your wife or your spouse, you get short with your kid, you know? Yep. That's what we do. We do it inside of our community. That's where we implode. And so it's looked at like, you guys are killing yourself. Well, let's look at the why. And I thought that was important to mention here, because I think that we should have some more conversation about what people that don't, those other percentage outside of the 76%, what are their thoughts? Why aren't they compassionate? Why aren't they sympathetic? Mm. Let's deal with that. And that was one of the things that came out.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to, if anybody's listening that may be thinking that, to really tap into the compassion and understanding why that is the case as well.
It's an interesting perspective, right? Like it's a really powerful point there. It's not necessarily, maybe it's less about changing their mind. Maybe it's figuring out why they're so angry, right?
Exactly.
In many ways.
Exactly. Why?
How old is your youngest child?
16 months.
16 months. Can I ask you a couple questions? Sure. Is it your daughter? Is that right?
My daughter, my son is 16 months and I have a daughter as well. She's 12.
Right. Okay. So your son who's 16 months, what is your biggest dream during this conversation? What do you hope will happen by the time he gets to our age?
Wow, that's a wonderful question. I just hope that he can experience unity amongst culture. I just hope that he can experience equality. You know, I can imagine for people that created a foundation for me to even be talking to you today, to be able to achieve the things that I've achieved. You know, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, Maya Angelou, I mean, so many leaders before us that paved the way, wanted to see people being able to use the same restroom. You know, that was their goal. And they wanted that. I would love to be able to see communities working together to identify the gap in systemic issues.
Yes.
I would love to see people's, all cultures coming together, because, you know, it shouldn't be an African-American just protesting. There should be all cultures coming together, because if all lives matter, all lives matter, right? Mm-hmm. You know, including black ones. So why isn't all the cultures coming together to support, you know, everyone that's alive? And so to be able to see that type of movement, all cultures being out there, you know, standing up in unity, saying this isn't right, you know, that's what I would like to see.
Does what's happening right now scare you?
It does. You know, having two boys, my other son is 8, especially knowing that he'll be driving. Let me share with you an experience that I had. I just thought about this. And it was a moment for me as well. My sister rented a car, right? It was a beautiful Charger. Camaro. It was a Camaro. Yes. It was tinted windows. It was white. It was beautiful. And my husband had left, and my mom wanted me to go to church with her, mm-hmm. and I was visiting her. And so I hopped in her car and could not find my way to her church. Got into this little community. And before I knew it, I saw myself getting tailed by police. And I was really scared. I was driving the speed limit. I didn't, you know, and I was kind of like, oh, okay, that's what. And he was like following me miles down.
Right.
And then I started to get a little nervous because I felt like I was being followed. And so I didn't know what was going on. And then that person left. And then I had two police officers start to follow me. And then when I got into the town, I couldn't find out. I was trying to use my GPS and I turned my signal on and made a right turn. Next thing I know, I got pulled over. And so when they pulled me over, the two police officers pulled over and one of them came out and they had their hand already where their gun was. And when he came there, he was very surprised to see that it was me in the car. I know he wasn't expecting that. I mean, this was a really cool car. I mean, I would drive a cool car, but I wasn't like that. You know, it was like the surprise on his face. Like, oh, I wasn't expecting you to be in here.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, officer, you know, what did I do? And he said, I didn't turn my light on, my signal, soon enough when I made that right turn. And I said, oh, so I was looking at my GPS and I didn't realize that the turn was just there. I said, the church is right around the corner. I'm not really sure where I'm going. As I was having that conversation with him, three other cops pulled up and were standing behind me. I was terrified.
Yes.
You know, and I was like, wow. And then before I knew it, I saw him give the signal, like, you know, and then he told me, well, we have another call. We have to get going.
Right.
And I sat there with my heart just beating, like, what if I, wasn't? What if it was my son?
Yeah.
You know, how would that have played out?
Yeah. It's scary for sure. And you know, I think the hypocrisy behind it is they're supposed to serve and protect. Who are they serving or protecting? And in your case, it certainly wasn't you in that moment, was it?
Right. You're not supposed to feel anxiety.
No.
When you come into contact with a person who's supposed to serve and protect you. That in itself is a distortion. That in itself is trauma. That in itself is what I mean by a gap in the system that has to be dealt with.
Yeah. No, that's very fair. Let's do this. I wasn't sure how to phrase this question, but if you had three things, because we always try to leave with three steps, right? And this one's a little bit different, but if you had three steps that were actionable, practical, and simple, and I don't know if it's relevant in this case, I don't know. Tell me what things people could do to be better about this. Let's leave it at that.
You know, I love questions like that because as a coach, I'm all about the how, you know, like, okay, good. We got the issue. We understand. How can we get to the root? How do we move from here? And that's what I love to talk about. And so forgive me if this comes off a little cheesy, but when you first started asking me, I'm already like, I always think of things. It just happens. Like,
yes.
Just so happened, all three of these words start with the P. I didn't try to do it. It just, it's the teacher in me, the coach in me, so that it's easy to remember, right?
Yes.
Now, if I had to say three things that we could do, the first one would be, of course, I'm a woman of faith, is prayer. You know, there's certain things that you can only manifest through prayer, right? And so being able to go before a higher power and to really speak and decree and declare the things that we desire to take place, speak it out into the atmosphere, right? And be consistent with that. And so prayer is one. And if you don't know what to say, guess what? You can say whatever you want. As long as it's from the heart, it'll be received. And that's the beautiful thing. You may not know what to say to a fellow brother or sister, but you can always say the right thing when you're talking to the King.
Yes.
So outside of prayer, I would say policy, because policy has a lot to do with systems. And I spoke a lot about that during our time together because it's that important to me. And so how can we change policies? So really thinking about policies that are in place that we can upgrade, right, for the advancement, the true advancement of our people as a whole, as one body, you know. And then the last key would be participate, you know, participate. Figure out there are people that have been called for a time like this. They are ready to voice their opinions. They are passionate. If you look into their eyes, you can see it in their eyes. They're speaking about the issue. God already knew this issue was going to come. It's taken him by no surprise, right? So he's already raised up a remnant of leaders to be able to take this charge. So when they do, my thing that I share with my community is to participate. You may not be on the front line, but hey, could you sign a petition?
Yeah.
You know, could you share a post? Could you share a heartfelt word of, you know, compassion? And could you show up at a walk? I mean, what can you do to participate?
Yeah.
And so prayer, policy, and participation is what I would say.
How important is it under that last P for participate? How important is it for people to look themselves in the mirror and authentically ask themselves what they think?
Very important. I think it's very important. I think that it has a large part to do with the healing as our nation, you know, and especially as our community. What do I think of this and what can I do? What can I do? You know, okay. If everybody took that stance, we would be better.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. This has been such a insightful and from my end, a little bit emotional conversation too. It's a lot of good stuff that comes up, right? And I have two daughters, 1 2 and 1 5, and I can only empathize what you're going through. Final thoughts.
My final thoughts for anyone who's listening is to know that just speaking from the African American community is that for those of you who have stood in the gap, who may not be of African American descent, thank you. You know, if no one tells you, I just want you to hear this and know that we appreciate you. For those of you who came out to protest, who stood up for the cause in any way, I just want to say thank you. And that you may not be heard or acknowledged or anything during this time. This is a battle that has been long in the making. And I appreciate you being a part. For those of you who are listening to this for the first time and not really, you know, feeling very uncomfortable, not really knowing where you're standing and still trying to digest this, I just want to encourage you to continue to be bold, to listen to information. It is information that allows you to get insight and can move you to transformation if you have an open heart. And so if you are listening, just continue to keep an open mind and hear from a place of compassion. And I appreciate you for listening. I do. And I appreciate you for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my honor, trust me. And at a time like this where it's difficult, where it's difficult to process emotion, difficult to process action, and sometimes it's challenging to your very core, your very sense of values and morals. It's good to have guidance. It's good to have you on the show. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, team, that's going to be it. I thought that was one of the best podcasts we've done, and I can't thank you enough for joining me. And team, special edition one. Look, if you found that of value, please let me know. I cannot thank Dr. White enough for coming on the show. And team, you know the drill. Review, and in this case, I don't normally say this. In this case, share this episode. This is an important one. On behalf of Dr. White, on behalf of myself, thank you for listening, and take care out there.
Don't forget, if you love this podcast, please leave a review. One of my goals is to support as many entrepreneurs and small business owners as possible with these simple, actionable, and practical tips. My team and I spend countless hours finding great guests who are experts in their field. And these people 100% volunteer to be on this show. And one of the best ways to help other people find this podcast is with your review. So if you would be so kind and subscribe and leave a review, this show can get out to more people and I would be forever grateful. So thank you in advance. Okay guys, thanks so much once more for tuning in. See you next week and have a great few days.